Please stay tuned for important disclosure information at the conclusion of this episode.
I'm Jeff Batak, Global Director of Manager Research for Morningstar Research Services.
And I'm Christine Benz, Director of Personal Finance for Morningstar, Inc.
Our guest on the podcast today has been called one of the most powerful women in finance. Sally Krawcheck started her career as an equity analyst at Sanford C. Bernstein, who had a reputation for impartial advice and criticism of conflicts of advice in the financial services sector prompted Fortune magazine to call her the last honest analyst. She later moved to Citigroup, where she served as CEO of the firm's Smith Barney unit, Citi's chief financial officer, and CEO of Citi's wealth management business. In the latter role, she was an early advocate of a fiduciary standard for the brokerage industry. She went on to Bank of America, where she served as president of the firm's wealth management unit. Sally is currently the CEO and co-founder of Elevest, a digital financial advisor for women launched in 2016. She is also owner and chair of Elevate Network, a global network of women committed to promoting gender equality in the workplace. In the spirit of full disclosure, Morningstar Inc. invested in Elevest in 2015 and 2019. And Morningstar Investment Management, LLC, a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc., provides consulting services to Elevest for their core portfolios. Sally, welcome to The Long View.
So glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
So much of your work in recent years has been focused on helping women achieve gender equality in the workplace and in their finances. Let's start with the gender pay gap. How much women are paid relative to men doing a similar job? It seems like that's getting better, but still not where it should be. Can you give us the state of the state?
Slowly, slowly. First of all, I'd say I love your words. I would probably be even more direct with what I'm spending my life trying to do, which is, you know, at Elevest, we are all about getting more money in the hands of women. And it's about getting women to parity in comparison to men. And so on the gender pay gap, a lot of ink spilled about this. Yes, there's some progress, but it's not nearly enough. We're decades away from white women earning at a similar rate to white men. We are 100 plus years away for black women, and we're 200 plus years away for Latinx women. So that doesn't, to me, feel very good. I'd say on top of that, there has been so much ink spilled, so many books written, so many articles, so many podcasts, encouraging women, cheering women on, giving women lots and lots and lots of advice on how to be aggressive but not too aggressive, and forceful but not too forceful, and ambitious but maybe not too ambitious. And I think women are doing their part here. It's, you know, it really is time for institutions to take a good hard look at how they are going to make not incremental changes, but significant changes if they want to be employers of choice and want to bring this to parity.
So let's talk about the steps that have been taken to address the gender pay gap. Most states have banned the practice of companies asking prospective employees about salary history, for example. Let's talk about why that might help and whether you think that will help.
Yeah. Well, it's a step. It's frankly one I wouldn't have thought of. But of course we all, when we're going to give an offer, a salary offer to someone, if we know what they made before, we end up anchoring in it. We just do, you know, well, oh, so they're making $50,000. Maybe I'll have to pay them 60. You know, boy, 51 sounds better. But I think it's just one issue. Another that I would point out is that women are socialized not to negotiate as much, not to be as aggressive. And so I know that I found over the course of my career, if you give an offer to someone and they negotiate, you may give them more money. If you give an offer to someone and they don't negotiate, you're never going to give them more money. And so, you know, these issues are so challenging because there's an inclination to, you know, it's the company's fault and it's his fault and he needs to. And you think of it as sort of, you know, caped evildoers paying these individuals less than those individuals, when in fact, it's a really mess of things. And so changing it is typically not as straightforward as, you know, you got a class and you sort of change everybody's mind. What it is as straightforward is just closing it. Just making sure. We actually had at Elevest not so long ago, a male engineer prospect gave him an offer. He negotiated female for exactly the same type of role. She did negotiate. We ended up giving him additional pay because he negotiated. We ended up giving her that as well because it really is the exact same job.
So given the fact that we're on the topic of women advocating for themselves on the salary front, I mean, what are some steps that you would advocate where they can do better and negotiate more aggressively on their own behalf?
Well, see, this is the thing. I think companies should do better. I just do. I think companies should say, here's our pay gap. And we as a company recognize that women have been socialized not to negotiate as much. We as a company recognize that individuals within this company, within middle management, have been brought up with the view that men are better at X and Y. The research is clear that men are promoted, white men are promoted based on potential, and women, people of color, women of color, minorities, promoted based on achievement. So the bar has historically been higher for these individuals outside of the business majority. We recognize these biases play into offers and promotions and raises, and therefore we are going to pull all of this data and we are going to close all the gender and racial and ethnic pay gaps. And I apologize for not answering your question, but you know, if the answer were women doing better and trying harder and doing it a certain way, we would already be at pay parity. Women are doing their part. You know, it's the companies that need to close this darn thing.
So that pay gap contributes to a lifetime earnings differential between men and women with similar educational attainment. Let's talk about the role that women's own choices, some of the things that happen in life contribute to that, specifically the breaks that women take, because that's a contributing factor as well. Can you talk about how that affects lifetime earnings versus men for women?
So, you know, women's choices. Society, you know, through the ages, we live in a patriarchal society. And our society really has dictated and dictates to us that, you know, women take more career breaks, that women are the caregiver, that they take care of the baby more often, they take care of the parents more often. And it is at that point when she has her first child that the pay gap really opens up. Some of it is also women step out of the workforce for a year or 2 years, which obviously impacts their earnings not only in those 2 years, but in the years after. You know, in the societies we have today, we can talk about it as being a woman's choice, but when we're the only developed country in the world that doesn't have mandated paid parental leave. And so a woman has to take potentially vacation time if she has it, disability if she has it, or maybe she has to be at work 2 days after she has a baby in order to keep her job. And therefore, we may say she has a choice, but she feels like she has no choice. Mm-hmm. But to stay home with her young colicky child, you know, who's just getting his or her start in life, I don't know that that's a real choice. As you phrase it, it feels like, well, you know, I could do this or I could do that. Sometimes, you know, families here today are being driven into choices that are not true choices. They are made from, you know, positions of somebody has to take care of this child and I don't have the ability to do it while I have to be at work. And so they'll leave the workforce. And society still dictates that it's a woman's place, not a man's place. And businesses dictate it because so many businesses today will still provide, if they provide a maternal leave, they may not provide a leave for the father or the non-primary caregiver. So there are absolutely some choices which are wonderful, which are, I'm going to step back for a period of time. I choose to. But there's some choices that really aren't choices.
So what are the approaches that you favor for addressing some of the issues that you just mentioned? I think that you alluded to paid parental leave as being an example of something that can help to ease some of these burdens or at least ensure that the burden doesn't fall so squarely on women as it has in the past. Are there other things that you would favor?
Yeah. Well, look, I'll tell you what we've done at Elevest. And we're a startup. So every dollar is precious for us as we work to, you know, reach scale, build a successful business. We have here for both primary and non-primary caregivers the same amount, in our case 12 weeks, paid parental leave. And the dads and the moms take it. The initial recommendation from our people ops group was, well, we should have, I can't remember, 12 weeks for primary caregiver and 6 weeks for non-primary, whatever it was. And as we talked through it as a leadership team, I said, we all know what we're saying, right? It's not primary number. It's male and female, man and woman. And we are a company that is all about getting more money in the hands of women, therefore improving women's lives. And we're just about to put in place a mommy track where the research is clear that when women take these leaves and men don't, the women are mommy tracked. Where the research is clear, as mentioned, this is where the gender pay gap really kicks in. So no way are we as Elevest going to do this. By the way, the research tells you that paid parental leaves pay for themselves in 1 year. I think the mistake, which obviously at Morningstar you'll recognize so well as analysts, the mental mistake we make is that we think of paid parental leave as being an expense when in fact it's an investment. Because if you provide this, the parents are more likely to come back and stay. And that if you don't provide it, they are more likely to quit, which means you not only have to replace them, you have to train their replacement. And it might not be an investment you want to make. Moms, no. But it's a smart investment.
Let's talk about the performance of companies with more women-friendly policies. Elevate Asset Management has collaborated with PAX World Management on the PAX Elevate Global Women's Index Fund. What's the thesis behind that index?
Well, the research is clear that diverse teams outperform other teams and outperform even smarter teams. So there is power in all kinds of diversity. And you can imagine, I always love to use the basketball analogy, which I won't go through the whole thing, but essentially if you have a basketball team's, I would argue, most important player is the point guard. And if you have 5 point guards, you're not going to make the NCAA final or probably even the tournament. And the same is true for if you have lack of diversity at an extreme, you hire a whole bunch of people who are exactly like yourself. Well, then, you know, you're not going to see around corners. You're not going to see opportunities. You're not going to have the debates that lead to fuller thinking that leads to better results, whether that's higher returns, lower risk, greater innovation, greater client engagement, greater employee engagement. These are the things that come from having more diverse teams, which in turn comes from having family-friendly policies, lower pay gaps or no pay gaps, so that you're making at least some of the steps towards having a more inclusive environment.
Do the data support that companies that advance women perform better than those that don't based on the research that you've done or research that's been done by collaborators?
Oh, there's so much research. And I would just put it slightly differently. I mean, advanced women, yes. It really, the research talks to diverse leadership teams, diverse boards. Part and parcel of that, of course, is advancing women. And again, it's not this group is better than that group. This group is a, no, it's diversity. And, you know, I typically use the example, my old industry, Wall Street. If you just want to sit back for a second and imagine an industry of which the trading floors were half women, 45, 50% people of color, rather than the more homogenous teams that are on the trading floors today, you know, do you think the financial crisis would have been worse? And intuitively, you know, it wouldn't have been. And the research backs up that homogenous teams tend to overtrust each other, that risk levels rise and fall, you know, outsized risk rises and falls with testosterone levels. And so if you can put in people with different points of view, different risk tolerances, I think we all intuitively know where the research points us, which is you might not have earned as much in the good times, but you wouldn't have lost as much in the bad times. And certainly in the case of Wall Street, we tend to get lulled into a sort of sense of false security. And then every X number of years, along comes a financial crisis that wipes out. Look, in the case of, you know, the 2007-08 crisis, I think Merrill lost something like 50 quarters of earnings in one quarter.
So speaking of how women invest, let's talk about what we know about how women invest. There have been studies that indicate that women don't trade as much as men. They tend to prioritize safety more than men. What do the data show about how women invest and how they might invest or approach investing differently than their male counterparts?
Yeah. So it's a great question. I'd say the biggest difference is that women don't invest as much as men do. And I'd say the biggest mistake, you know, when we talk about men and investing, what's the biggest mistake? Probably overtrading, spending too much in fees, believing they can buy this stock at the right time, sell that mutual fund at the right time. And typically, you know, it's hard for anybody to outperform the market over any reasonable period of time. Those aren't the mistakes women make. Women just don't invest as much. Now, what that tends to do is to lead to what I consider to be flawed thinking that, oh, well, that means women are risk averse. That's it. They're risk averse. And what that intuitively positions it as is says, well, obviously, you know, the way the industry is built is the right way to invest. And therefore, if women aren't partaking of it, they aren't investing as much, then there's something I wouldn't say quite wrong with women, but there's something wrong with women. They're just risk averse. They need more financial education. Maybe they need better relationships. They need to take more risk. They need to. Elevest was really the first company, the first investing company that said, what if instead of making the assumption that, yeah, the products and services, the way of approaching the market are gender neutral. It's as good, men find it just as good, women find it just as good, no problem. What if instead at Elevest we said, what if we change the approach? Maybe it's not that women are risk averse. Maybe they don't like what we're selling. That could be the case. Maybe they're staying away in droves, not because they need more financial education, which by the way, so do men. Maybe they're staying away in droves because they're not attracted to watching CNBC and picking which mutual fund and, you know, trading. Maybe that's the case. And so, you know, at Elevest, we built something that was 1,000% built around how women want to invest. And no, it's not. They are interested in taking less risk.
So what findings have you built the Elevest offering around then?
Well, what we found is that women are not motivated by the trading. They're not even particularly motivated by a goal of having more money. They're motivated by their financial goals. They are motivated to invest if they can see themselves getting to starting the business they're dreaming about in 5 years. They're motivated to invest if they could see themselves buying the home they want in 7 years, or having the baby in 2, retiring well, taking the trip around the world, short-term, you know, all long-term, medium-term investments. Those are the things that motivate them. And they really are looking for someone who they trust, which is hard because that financial crisis, we hear from women still, I don't know that I can trust this industry. But they are looking for someone who likely is a fiduciary, so therefore legally obligated to put their interest ahead of the company's own, who can put together an investment portfolio that can get them to their goals. And there are blockers that just stand in the way. Gosh, this isn't resonating with me. Gosh, I'd love to at least learn about investing intentionally, as we call it at Elevest. We do intentional investing. You know, I'd like to invest for impact or learn about it. I don't see that, you know, that's difficult to get to. I'd like to, if I have a financial advisor, have someone who I feel like gets me. Easy to say, harder to do if the workforce doesn't reflect you back to yourself. And we hear a lot from women, not me, I'm not saying this, it's women, you know, telling us they didn't feel like they were understood. They felt like they were made to feel not smart. They were talked to in jargon. I could go on and on and on, but these things really matter. They add up and they really matter, such that in the existing industry, women have been staying away in droves.
So can you give an example of how you structured your proposition to surmount some of those issues that you mentioned? Like, what are some of the differences that a woman using your service would notice between maybe a rival service that's offered in the traditional way?
Well, look, first of all, our rival is really cash. You know, that's our biggest competition is cash and inertia. And so one difference, which doesn't sound like much, but is important, is we talk with her. We don't talk at her. We're not all about how smart we are. We're not all about every last feature that she, you know, we put in jargon. So it's not just impossible for her, but most people to understand. When I say we talk with her, we are with her on social. You know, we don't see social as being a series of press releases of how great we are. And I know folks are going to listen to this and they're going to say that's just marketing, but these things really engaging with her on her terms where she is and being responsive to her as opposed to just talking about yourself, these actually matter. And then the product, we are the first out of all the women investing initiatives out there, and there have been probably half a zillion, we are the only ones who changed the underlying product and changed it in the way we just spoke about. We are the only one who takes into account one's gender, that women live longer than men. That matters, obviously. Women's salaries peak sooner than men. I would argue non-binary individuals as well. And so typical investment portfolio is fine if you're going to die sooner, but if you're going to live longer, it might not, you know, if you don't take that into account, it might not be adequate.
And how about that goals orientation? How do you incorporate that idea into the offering, sort of the focus on goals versus just a pure performance focus?
Yeah, it's, look, our entire reason for being is to get her to her financial goals. And so you will see nowhere on our site whether we out or underperform, pick relevant index or irrelevant index, the S&P 500. What does it matter? It doesn't matter. It's not our goal because we're not just trying to get her more money or the most money. It is putting together diversified investment portfolios. Essentially, they're individualized target date funds, which is if she comes through, we help her calculate how much home she can afford, how much she needs to retire at the age of 65 with 90% of her income at the time annually available to her every year through the rest of her life, how much she should put aside to start a business in X years. A lot of us having to tell her, no, you actually can't afford to retire, have the five kids, buy the home, start the business, take the trip around the world. All that's not going to work. And so at Elevest, also really important and unique to us, is she can make trade-offs amongst those goals. This one is first. You know, this one we'll put, you know, on the back burner for a period of time. Invest for both of these simultaneously in this way. And so the portfolios are all about reaching her financial targets, which we help her calculate in the substantial majority of markets. If she's off track, we let her know she's off track and we let her know how to get back on track, which can be enormously comforting if you have a long-term portfolio and the market gets tough to know, oh, you know, it felt like I was freaking out, but, you know, I'm off track, but not by a lot. I, instead of having 70% chance of reaching my goal, it's 60, it's 50. In order to get back to 70% chance of reaching my goal, I have to invest another 1,000. That feels manageable, or retire 3 days later. That feels manageable. And so in a way, I sort of think of Elevest taking all the sophistication of what, you know, our industry does, of what Morningstar does so well, and sort of turning it into plain common sense and plain English.
It seems like one of the more enveloping, I suppose, adjustments that one would want to make to their approach in serving women is to encourage them to invest more aggressively, which I think is a theme that you noted earlier in our conversation, one of the reasons being longer life expectancies. Is that a fair assumption that laces through a lot of what you do at Elevest and in constructing portfolios for the women you serve?
Well, it sort of feels like we're going back to the underlying supposition of your question is that women don't invest aggressively enough. I actually think it's that women don't invest enough. We see nothing here that says when they do that they invest less aggressively than men. It's not, what we're seeing is not, hey, women are investing, but they're just in 2-year bonds. That's what they're in. The dudes are all in, you know, internet stocks, but women are just in 2 years. But no, that's not what's happening. Women are in cash. And so it's, to me, it's not, they're not investing aggressively. They're just not investing. And so when they come here, one thing we don't do is ask them to make decisions that they don't have the knowledge, background, expertise to make, like how aggressive do you want to be? So it's really interesting because, and y'all probably know this as well or better than I do, that when you ask someone what their risk tolerance is, nobody knows it until they go through in 07 or 08. They just don't. Let's just call a spade. We answer it, you know, and what we find a gender difference is men will answer the question and women will, oh, wait a second, I got to go figure out what it is. I wonder if there's a book I can read. Should I talk to some friends? And so at LFS, we're like, look, we're all about having you reach your goal. And so, and we're a fiduciary and we've got tons of experience. And so the amount of risk you should take in your retirement portfolio is this. You know, we don't talk in those words. We say, here's the portfolio, right? And it's got more risk than a home goal that's, you know, got a five-year time horizon. Or an emergency fund, which has, you know, very little slash no risk in it. And so by guiding her to this is what you want to achieve, this is what it takes to get there. And by the way, we'll track you the whole way. You should be in between, you know, here's what the growth of the money is and here's what it should be. You know, 90% of the time it should be above this and 90% of the time it should be below that. And if you're tracking within this sort of corridor, you're in good shape. If you fall off, we'll let you know. Those are the things that get her to invest as opposed to staying in cash.
And so what percentage of the current account holders that you serve came to you 100% in cash?
Oh, I don't have that. We also take rollovers, et cetera. But what I can tell you is that we get very few from traditional competitors. I can remember a handful of times when someone said, oh, look, we just had a portfolio come over from insert name of digital advisor. Or, oh, look, we just had a portfolio come over from, I mean, our millionaire clients, and we've got any number of those, we'll see that. They'll come over from, you know, one of the big traditional firms. But typically, you know, the majority of what comes over are rollovers, you know, sort of IRAs, 401ks coming over in cash.
So let's talk about the service. You talked about how engagement is so important and, you know, making sure that you're having that dialogue with women. So let's talk about the service tiers that you offer to clients. It seems like the level of engagement varies, correct?
Do you mean by that human interaction?
Yes.
So this, all investing firms, in my opinion, are some combination of people and technology. That is what they offer. And we have this great debate in the industry about people versus technology. People, you know, as if there'd be no more people, as if, you know, all companies don't use technology. I think it's just a matter of where on the spectrum one rests. And so we have a spectrum at Elevest. And sitting here today, one can get a digital-only portfolio. The cost for it is 25 basis points. You know, certainly you can engage with our customer service folks. I hope it's not for too long, but there can be human engagement. The next offer is a $50,000 minimum, 50 basis points, and you get access to a certified financial planner and executive coach. The next level is $1 million, high net worth, you get all and a financial advisor. In all of those are tech enabled. At the high net worth, a private wealth level, the tech is less visible. The tech we're building is really to leverage the financial advisors. And so they might say, oh, I don't work for a tech first company. Well, you do. It's, you know, you've just got a, I was going to say a thicker human layer, but of course that's a poor visual.
Yeah. You mentioned that one of the tiers includes the executive coaching. Can you talk a little bit more about that, the extent to which the career coaching is intertwined with the advice you're giving for the investment portfolio?
Yeah, you know, I was really skeptical of this. Having grown up in the traditional industry, we manage the money after you make it. And those are different skill sets, they're different places, you know, we're good. But the research kept coming back that women are saying, oh, you can help me with money. Can you help me make more money? And then can you help me invest it? We weren't the first. There's research out there. I think I saw one piece, and I apologize because I can't remember who sponsored it, but it was, what is the number one thing women want from their banks? Like, oh, I'd like to make, you know, make more money work. And of course, banks like, yeah, not what we do. But we said, you know what, if we're going to be, I would say I'm a recovering research analyst, we're going to be research-based, and this is what's coming up. Let's see, you know, let's sort of test it. And it's tested, it's doing well. It's not the primary reason people come to us, but as they are engaging with us, it's been a really interesting added benefit.
So you have talked a lot about how financial advisors don't necessarily serve female clients well. Let's talk about that, what we know about how financial advisors serve women and how we know when women aren't happy with that relationship.
Well, they leave.
Yeah.
So in the year after her husband's death, women leave their joint financial advisor at a rate of 70, 80, 90%. In a way, it doesn't sort of matter what they say, just the results are there. I was running these big companies. I remember I'd stand up on stage and be like, well, you know, we brought in this much in assets and this, and we lost this much to death, right? And sort of this view of, well, that's just sort of the way it is. But the money goes to someone. And what might be viewed as traditional relationships, man and a woman, women outlive their husband by 6 to 8 years. 90% of women manage their money on their own at some point in their lives. And what we hear again and again and again and again and again to back up those exit numbers is women say, I just didn't feel like he was my financial advisor. He and my husband would play golf and I would go to the meetings and they wouldn't sort of talk to me. And I never really understood, and there was a lot of jargon, and now I'm going to take the money and go to the bank and just keep it safe. When women outsource the management of their money to their partner or spouse, when that money comes back to them, there is a negative surprise 74% of the time. 74% of the time. That is not chance. That is, you know, she's not involved, probably the husband, because of societal pressures, is acting like everything's okay. And when that money comes back to her, she says, whoa, that's a negative surprise, and I am the heck out of here. I will add one thing, that when I was at these big companies, we would do all kinds of focus groups and tests and all that stuff. And there was a group of meetings we did in which the financial advisor would meet with a couple, and we'd watch it, you know, behind the glass, right, to see what the interaction was. And when they would leave, we would say to the financial advisor, what percent of the time do you spend talking to him versus her? And the financial advisor, well, you know, we talked about the football game a little bit. Yeah, it's 55% him, you know, 45% her. And then we'd run the tape and it would be like 85-15 or 90-10. And they would underestimate how much they spent talking to the woman and underestimate how much they'd spent talking to the man.
Do you think that the industry is coming to grips with this? Have you seen any positive strides on that front at the major firms where they're perhaps doing a better job of of serving not just men, but also women and being attuned to their needs?
I don't know. You would know this better than I do. You know, I'm so busy trying to build Elevest. You know, building a startup is so hard and so all-consuming that I really don't pay much attention to what the competitors are doing or what the more traditional firms are doing. I know there's a lot of talk about it. There's a lot of energy around it. It's just hard. It's hard to change the complexion of a successful business. It's hard. People say to me, Sally, you ran Merrill. Why didn't you do an Elevest at Merrill? And no, could not have done it. Innovator's dilemma, which is that it's a very large, extremely successful business, earning multiple billions of revenue, does business in a certain way, and to come in and say, well, let's change that way, focus on an entirely new client base that has different needs than the one that we're serving, go tech-enabled, which, you know, sort of this tech-first, which is going to have the benefit of, I believe, you know, more customized investment portfolios beyond what the human brain can put together at a much lower price. I mean, it's good for the client, right? Because that money ends up in her pocket, but means less profitability for the existing company. Okay, so let's change everything, take a very successful business. If we are successful in transforming it, we're going to earn less? Yeah, you know, I don't think so.
So you've argued that better gender diversity can serve all firms well, but let's talk about that on investment firm staffs. How do you think that can help them serve their clients better?
Well, they can earn higher returns. I mean, the research tells you that women are as good or better investment managers than men are. We can debate the research, but I don't see anything that says, yeah, women are terrible at this, just the worst. And yet, and these numbers I'm sure have moved a little bit, 90% of mutual fund managers are men and 98% of mutual fund dollars are managed by men. What is so fascinating about it is this is an industry that supposedly is about looking for the highest risk adjusted returns. And so we've been so overwhelmingly socialized that this is a man's game that we actually look past the research that points us to a way to improve the results.
So you were an outspoken advocate of a fiduciary standard for advisors while you were head of Citi's wealth management business. That was more than 10 years ago. Why has a uniform fiduciary standard been so hard to enact?
Because regulatory change is hard without a crisis. I've spent some time with the SEC back in my prior life, and getting regulatory change through is incredibly difficult. It typically happens after a financial crisis when there's, you know, everyone clearly sees the need for a change and there's drive for a change. And after that, it just tends to fade away. And so coming out of the last financial crisis, of the things that people said, oh my gosh, we have to move on, this was not it. But I do think it's just not cool. you know, and look, it's just to get to one standard so that the investor doesn't have to try to get it. You know, I'll never forget when I started at Merrill, and there was still some impetus and momentum around of a potential change, and asking the lawyers there for, yeah, look, I know it's easy, you know, we can have a straightforward statement that a fiduciary is a high standard, but there are lots of differences between them, whether it's, you know, advertising. Could you just pull together all the differences for me? Just because I really like to understand, you know, what those nuances are and how to maybe take the best of one standard and the best of another. And they pulled together, I think it was 12 pages of small type written differences. And it wasn't just 12 like letter size pages or legal size pages. They printed, I haven't seen one since, they printed on one of those like big sheets. And I'd be like, oh. So I would put forth, I used to say, nobody in the industry understood all those differences, like nobody. And then how do we expect an individual investor to make an informed decision, right? You don't. It's not fair to the individual investor.
And so do you think it's going to take another crisis to enact the change that we need to achieve a uniform fiduciary standard?
Well, that's what history would tell us.
So there's been a reckoning in some industries over sexual harassment in the workplace. You wrote an essay about why the financial services industry never really had its own Me Too moment. Why is that? Can you sort of restate that thesis?
I think there are a few reasons, an important one of which is that many in the industry require all their employees to sign agreements that sexual harassment will be handled through the arbitration process. That's a problem. And some of the research would tell you that financial services, in particular wealth management, when you survey employees of the industry, would tell you that the incidence of sexual harassment is high in comparison to other industries. And so what I think you see is if this is happening, but it's being quieted by the arbitration clauses and confidentiality agreements that are signed on payouts, that gets to, you know, there, it isn't a surprise that you wouldn't be hearing much about it. I think the other thing that's happening is that you've seen women in other industries come together and rally around forming a Time's Up chapter.
Right.
And rallying around getting more women in the industry, more progress on diversity. So we've seen it in Silicon Valley, where the women there formed All Raise and are doing a lot of really incredible work to bring other women into the business, to fund women entrepreneurs, to coach women, et cetera, et cetera. This just hasn't happened in Wall Street and the investing industry. And I think another reason is because in Silicon Valley, you are more successful if you collaborate. That, I'm seeing a great company, let me share it with you, and next time you'll share one with me. And, oh, you're seeing something on this company I didn't think about, and I've got experience over here that you don't have. And so there's a collaborative environment. On Wall Street, it's a competitive environment, and it's competitive across businesses. If I'm a private banker and I'm competing with you for the client, or I'm an investment banker and I'm competing with you and a client. And then I would argue even amongst women in the same company that, you know, if you looked up and you said there are, you know, there's a table of 12 leaders and there are two women, and there were two women 5 years ago and there was two women 15 years ago, then there were two women 20 years ago, then you're probably going to think there are going to be two women. And in order for me to get that seat at the table, I'm not competing against Joe or Jim or Steve or Todd. I'm competing against Susie. And so, you know, you may have heard of the Queen Bee syndrome. You know, that's a woman who doesn't help other women advance. And you always hear this sort of judgmental, very judgmental. Well, some of the worst people I've seen for advancing women are other women. As if, look, you know, blame the women. And you're like, yeah, because it only made economic sense for these women to be queen bees, because they knew if they wanted that seat at the table, who they were competing with. And so I think it's a lot of different things. I think the thing it isn't that the industry doesn't have sexual harassment. It is, there are factors that have kept them from coming to light as much in this go round.
So you've obviously had an extremely successful career in the investment industry. Do you have any tips for women in the industry about how to navigate their careers?
Sometimes you need to recognize it's not you, it's him or her. So there's so much of these, you know, I know what I'm supposed to say in answer to your question. It's supposed to be just work hard and take risk and you go girl and don't let him get you down and speak your mind and bring your best self to work. And there's all this stuff, right? I'm just going to be perfectly honest. If you're not getting ahead, it might not be your fault. And the research would tell you that that can very much be the case, that middle management is where diversity goes to die, and that your boss might be a terrifically wonderful human being, man, woman, non-binary, but they have been brought up in a society in which leaders are men, in which when you picture, you know, a CEO, it's a man. When you picture a senior executive, when you picture a trader, when you picture a money manager, all of us picture a white man. And if you are a white man, you know, look, you might be more comfortable promoting people who remind you of yourself. You went to the diversity research symposium and you went to the unconscious bias training, but if you are only promoting two people a year or hiring one person a year or three people a year, you can fall back on what feels more comfortable to you. And so at LFS, we call him or her Todd. Todd, you might work for a Todd, and everybody loves Todd, but Todd just never gets around to promoting you. And so I think recognizing when you work for a Todd, and no matter how many more career books you buy, it isn't going to matter. You're not going to change him. And your company, which says it's a meritocracy and lets their managers manage, is not going to take him out. Because he's, you know, his results are good. He's hitting his sales plan. He's passing his audits and he's just not making the diversity target. Oh, well, but we have lots of things we're trying to do. If you are in a position where you can transfer departments, get a new manager, branch out, leave the company, there are times when I promise you it is not you, no matter what that dog-eared, you go girl, be your best book tells you. There are times it is, honestly, you cannot work any harder. It is not you. I bet you no one else has ever given that advice before.
Sally, this has been a great conversation. We have really enjoyed hearing about these issues and hearing your enthusiasm for making things better. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on The Long View. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to and rate The Long View for Morningstar on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can follow us on Twitter at Christine_Benz.
And at SYouth1, which is SYOUTH and the number 1. Finally, we'd love to get your feedback. If you have a comment or a guest idea, please email us at thelongview@morningstar.com. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
This recording is for informational purposes only and should not be considered investment advice. Opinions expressed are as of the date of recording. Such opinions are subject to change. The views and opinions of guests on this program are not necessarily those of Morningstar Inc. and its affiliates. Morningstar and its affiliates are not affiliated with this guest or his or her business affiliates unless otherwise stated. Morningstar does not guarantee the accuracy or the completeness of the data presented herein. Jeff Batak is an employee of Morningstar Research Services, LLC. Morningstar Research Services is a subsidiary of Morningstar Inc. and is registered with and governed by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Morningstar Research Services shall not be responsible for any trading decisions, damages, or other losses resulting from or related to the information, data analyses, or opinions, or their use. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results. All investments are subject to investment risk, including possible loss of principal. Individuals should seriously consider if an investment is suitable for them by referencing their own financial position, investment objectives, and risk profile before making any investment decision.